Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Searching for something to put a smile back on your face. Just remembering unusual times that can come from an unusual place. You need a partner for the ride, 'cause everybody needs a Clyde. So set your worries to the side. Just ask, say the word. Greatest things in life all come in a pair. They say hindsight's 20/20, but that ain't far enough behind me. So if you want the sweetest honey, I think hindsight's 1990. There's no need to pretend I got a hand I can lend, 'cause when you really need a friend, just ask. Shit
90
Shows Taught Me.
Shit 90 Shows Taught Me was not filmed before a live studio audience.
Welcome back to Shit 90 Shows Taught Me. I'm Jess Sterling, here with my co-host, Sarah Ferguson. Sarah, how are you?
Good evening, sweet princess. I'm here.
It's gotten creepy already.
I've got my favorite dresses, and I'm going to lure you into this alleyway. You're gonna suck your blood.
If you couldn't tell already, or you didn't read the title of this podcast, we're going to be talking all things vampires, Interview with the Vampire. And we're not alone. We couldn't go through this alone because neither one of us has ever seen this movie, despite it being apparently a really big thing, a really big deal in the 90s. We'll find out, because we brought on somebody who specially requested this movie, I believe. Someone who I'm super, super excited to get on the podcast, who I've talked to once before, but she's back. She's here. Sarah Carradine. Sarah, how are you?
Say goodbye to the light.
Who's the creepier vampire?
Listen, the thing is everyone in this movie is creepy.
Yeah.
That's the answer.
The Sarahs are here to turn you into a vampire, because we never got the chance.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're giving you the option. Jessica, do you want to be a vampire? Yes or no?
But I want to live.
No, that's not an option.
Honestly, I'd rather die.
No, we've taken you to the brink of death, and now your choice is, do you want to truly die the true death, or will you say goodbye to the light?
I feel like it'd be better to die, right? Because vampires being immortal, I feel like being immortal is, not all it's cracked up to be. Because, imagine how many people, if you fell in love or something, you're just constantly watching people you fall in love with die. And on top of that, who wants to... Okay, first of all, Lestat drinking... No, it wasn't Lestat, it was Louis, who drinks all the, rat blood and stuff. Count me out of that. Poor poodles, by the way.
Yeah, the poodles need special treatment after this movie.
Yeah.
Justice for the poodles.
Yes. Yeah, and then you can have vampire poodles, though.
Oh, that would be fun. That actually, can you imagine little fangs on them? That would be so fun.
I totally can.
So, Sarah, tell us about your memories of this movie, because this came out in 94. So did you see this movie, when it came out, or is this...
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. I was reflecting the other day that I saw sort of a lot of movies that are canon from the 70s, 80s, and 90s when they actually came out, before anybody knew what the twist was or what the answer was, and before they became, you know, known, so that a lot of people now can't watch the movie without the baggage that comes with it, except for you two with Interview with the Vampire. I don't know how much you knew about it before, but I saw it in 1994. I was 34 years old at the time. I was working for Opera Australia as a director. So I was kind of in that whole world of frocks and wigs and makeup and things. And for us, you know, as for Anne Rice, Tom Cruise was a terrible, terrible piece of casting. Like, we couldn't believe when we heard that he was going to be Lestat.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I mean, I'm not a Tom fan, but I am a huge fan of him in this movie.
Interesting. So have you ever read, because I didn't even realize until I started looking at like the trivia that it was based on a novel. Did you ever read Anne Rice's novel?
I didn't read the novels, not because I was anti the novels. I just never read them. Mm-hmm. But she had some very interesting ideas for who should play Lestat. When she was writing the novel, she was thinking of Rutger Hauer. And Rutger Hauer, a German actor, is absolutely stunning, icy, Germanic. Mm-hmm. You'll know him from Blade Runner, you know, like Tears in Rains, Time to Die. So he's also got that great sort of darkness to him. But I was also reading she wanted, and I didn't realize this, she wanted Alain Delon. Alain Delon is a French sort of new wave actor that we were all sort of madly in love with in the 80s and would sort of flock to art house films and watch French films in subtitles and go out and smoke Gaulois and think that we were kind of incredibly cool. And then she wanted Julian Sands. And Julian Sands is an interesting, he's like an English Rutger Hauer. He's a very chiseled, handsome, blonde, pale man.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, all of them had aged out by the time it came to casting this one. And again, Daniel Day-Lewis is what the who Neil Jordan wanted, and in fact he was going to do the film until apparently just before it started. Then he dropped out.
Wow!
And then they offered it to Johnny Depp.
Oh my! Of course, yes. I feel like every single thing I ever read about anything, it's like first they offered it to Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
I mean, Johnny Depp is like very picky. He's like, no. It's like he only chooses like very specific things. Yeah, he has all the yeses for what's Creepo, Mr. Creepo.
Oh,
what's
Burton.
Tim Burton. It's like Tim Burton. It's like Johnny Depp. Let's do this like yes, thing, instantly. And it's like, yeah, no problem, bro.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then how did we come to Tom Cruise?
Unknown, but we did. And everybody thought Neil Jordan was completely mad. And it turned out not so much. So it's very hard for, I think, us now or listeners now or the youth of today when they think about Tom Cruise and his Scientology and his thoughts and feelings and his kind of, you know, perfect rigidity of acting with the action heroes that he plays. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to imagine him saying yes to this intensely erotic 2 hours of bisexuality, yes, homosexuality, bestiality, gorgeous, just seductive, sensuous eroticism. And he does it so completely that now we can't think of Lestat without thinking of him, both in his beautiful youth, his beautiful eternal youth, and his varying stages of decrepitude, let us say.
Yeah, every time, I was saying this to Sarah, every single time I thought that Lestat was finally done in this movie, it was like, nope, he's back again. Nope, he's back again. I was like, of course. I mean, it's Tom Cruise, so, like, you know he's going to be a major part of the film, obviously, right? Like, you know he's going to be in the most of the movie. But then when they actually, like, set him on fire, I thought, oh, okay, he's dead. You know, that's it. Put him in a river with some alligators. See you later. But yeah, like this movie was super interesting.
But it was actually see you later to the alligators.
I know.
That's how he revived himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at that, I mean, at that time that the film came out, you could have easily believed that he would die at any point in the movie. It's just that now we think, Tom Cruise, no, he's not going to die. But then,
yeah.
No.
I mean, at that point, he already was in Risky Business.
Mm-hmm.
So that was big, I believe. Like, he was already in The Outsiders, Top Gun. So, I mean, he was probably like an up-and-coming name in Hollywood.
Oh, very much so. And don't forget, he'd also done Days of Thunder with our Knickers. He saw Nicole Kidman in a film called Dead Calm, which is a very creepy three people stranded on a boat in calm water. It's a sort of, it's a horror. He'd seen her in that film and he said, get her for Days of Thunder. And he got her for Days of Thunder and he got her
as a wife.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
And they went on to do Far and Away together as well with, you know, some sort
of adopted kids. Did you remember that, Jess, that Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise have kids together?
Nope.
They adopted two children.
I honestly don't think I knew that. The only thing I know is like there's the Nicole Kidman, like Keith Urban thing, which I knew.
Yeah. And then she gave birth to children. But yeah, like that, she adopted children with Tom Cruise. They're adults now.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And they're in Scientology, Bella and Connor.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, there's way more famous faces in this movie than I would have expected, to be honest, because again, like this is just not a movie that was ever on my radar. I'm not really into scary movies, not really into horror in general. I know vampires had like a big thing, right? I'm thinking like during the Twilight time and all of that, like vampires really came on strong. But it's just not a movie I ever saw. And so then all of a sudden I see Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise and Antonio Banderas shows up. And like Kristen Dunst is in this as an itty bitty little baby.
Stephen Ray, who's a fantastic Irish actor that's worked with Neil Jordan a lot, both in drama and comedy. He's Santiago. He's absolutely fantastic. Tandy Newton, Australia's own Tandy Newton, is the one of the house servants.
Yes. Yvette, I think is her name. Yes.
Yvette, yes.
I saw her and I was like, wait a minute. That's the woman from Westworld. Like, immediately I was like, I know her. But she obviously looks like a lot younger.
Yeah.
But yeah, like,
we were all a lot younger in 1994. Exactly. I can tell you that.
And then, of course, Christian Slater. But yeah, and as far as Kristen Dunst, too, like, honestly, I think she impressed me most just given her age in the film that I was like, every time she was on screen, she was popping for me. I was interested to see what she would do next. You know, Claudia, I just think it's like a fascinating character given that she's a child when she's turned and she doesn't ever get the maturity to be able to handle it. Right. You know, she does these like evil manipulative things, which I was like very into. I was like, get it, Claudia, like ruin Lestat's life, please.
She was 12. This is her first on-screen kiss with Brad Pitt. She said it was yucky.
I mean, yeah, she's 12. Mm-hmm. Gross.
She said he had cooties.
Yeah.
She didn't want to kiss him.
No, this was very, like you said it earlier, like this was a very like sexually charged film. Like there's so much going on with it, right? Between like Lestat and Louis and just how they turn these vampires and like how sexual it is. I don't know that I was ready for that either. Like, Sarah, were you not completely baffled when I think it was Louis started like straight up munching on some girl's lips? I was like, what is it? Like he got blood from her lips. I'm like, is that really like fattiest part of her body to like?
I mean, for me, that didn't stand out. The breasts.
Oh,
the focusing and the sucking on the breasts was the thing that was like, okay, so that's where we're taking blood out now. No problem. Sounds good to me. So no, like, I mean, for me, like at times it felt like super progressive because especially when Louis and Lestat were brought on Claudia and they were like, we're going to go forward as a family. So you're saying in 1994, we're going to have Lestat and Louis like show as like a gay couple with a child, like with a young girl. fabulous, amazing. I was like, that's like so interesting that they're like going forward with that. And they call themselves a family unit. And they were like, we are your dads. And I was like, full on, love this for you, Louis and Lestat. Like, obviously, two totally different mentors in young Claudia's life. Very different types of father figures and mentor figures. But I thought that was incredibly interesting. What do you, like, how did you, like, back in the 90s, how did you, like, interpret that, Sarah?
So last century, and you got to think that Bill Clinton was your president at the time. And Neil Jordan's from Ireland. I'm trying to be very tactful here, but there's a conservatism that has blossomed in the early 21st century, both in both of our countries, where in the 80s and 90s all kinds of shit happened and nobody, you know, turned a hair particularly. And it's interesting, Jess, that you call this a horror film, because in a way it's not a horror film. I mean, there are slightly scary moments and a couple of sort of jump moments, but it's really this erotic tale of existential dread and the turning of time. There's all kinds of things which I absolutely loved. And Neil Jordan, who has been married to two women, works a lot in the queer space. He did The Crying Game famously, but he also did Breakfast on Pluto. And there's a fluidity to his works, and there's a fluidity to actors like Stephen Ray, not necessarily a sexual or a gender fluidity, but like a total fluidity of how they can move from comedy to drama, from sexy to not sexy, from gay to queer to straight to non-binary to whatever. It's a very European sensibility, I think, and it's very interesting that that Anne Rice thought of Alain Delon, because I don't know if you know him, but when you see him, he is a very beautiful man. And the New Wave had that, the actors of the New Wave had that fluidity. I mean, they were generally heterosexual, but there was an Alain to them, you know, that they had. And so that is brought to these American actors. And to Brad and Tom's complete credit, they inhabited that milieu very well. And you think about young Louis, he's a Creole, apparently. So he's growing up in a pre-American world.
He was an owner of a plantation.
Yeah, 1791 is the year I'm seeing online in Spanish Louisiana.
He was 24 in 1791. So obviously 1776, so he was born pre-America, like the Declaration of Independence, but yeah, he was growing up in the South. Obviously he owned slaves,
right? Yeah, like, we see them.
He set his slaves free in one point, because I mean they were like terrified of him. He was like, I'm a monster, please go.
I don't think he was emancipating them because it was the right thing to do.
I don't think Louis was thinking about that.
He was thinking about his kind of existential torture. And the interesting, like, relation, I mean, we're sort of jumping, well, I'm jumping around here because I tend to do this, but when we get to Paris, and it really is Paris, and that's one thing that films of the, you know, the 70s, 80s and 90s did, was they actually went to the places. So it wasn't Toronto for San Francisco.
I was just going to say, it's always like Vancouver, Toronto.
I mean, in Prague for absolutely any European city, but Prague only looks like Prague. But sorry, not to sound incredibly snobby, but I don't mean that. I mean, there's a taste and a smell and a feel, you know, architecturally, even if you haven't been to a place, you recognize it as a very particular place. So the scenes in Paris are incredible. And they all did go there. So it gives that feel, that very, it is a very, the sensuality of it, the feeling of it, the grit of it, the age of it. And when you're talking about immortals who feel the weight of years, it's fantastic to go to an old city that has this weight of years on it. And then he finds Lestat's maker or lover, or partner or boyfriend or ex or whatever, and is wanted by him. So it's this sort of circular relationship.
Yeah, Louis just always seems to be coveted by somebody. He's just forever coveted. And the poor guy, like, the thing is I really, really liked Louis as a character. I mean, like, I felt for him, right? Because Lestat is just shown as this kind of, like, sociopathic monster. And then you have poor Louis who, you know, his wife and his unborn child had died. So he's pretty traumatized by that. Like, he doesn't even really have, like, a will to live. He becomes this vampire and literally, like, feels like he can't die. But he doesn't want to take others' lives, right? Like, he's uncomfortable with the idea of sucking blood to the point where he's, like, drinking rat blood, drinking dog blood, like, whatever he can to basically avoid taking from humans. And then, like, I don't know, I really enjoyed Louis and Claudia, like, as a pair in their relationship and kind of just how, like, he took on that parenting role. But I think, I don't know, I'm curious what we all think, like, would have happened with Claudia and Louis had Lestat not been around as, like, the other parental figure. Because even though she still has the maturity of, what, a 10-year-old or whatever age she is when she turns, I feel like she'd probably be a little bit more well-adjusted if Lestat wasn't around, like, spoiling her and basically teaching her pretty awful things all around.
I think that Claudia had it in her from the very beginning. Like, it didn't really take much pushing from Lestat for her to become this, like, mass murderer. For me, I kind of enjoyed Lestat and Claudia's relationship more. I thought there was times where it was absolutely hilarious. Like, for example, my favorite part in the entire movie was when Claudia was getting her dress hemmed and then she killed her seamstress. And Lestat was like, well, guess who's going to do your dress now, okay? Who's going to finish it? I thought that was so funny. Like, I loved it. And I love, like, also when, like, like, when, like, she killed, like, her piano teacher and he was like, oh, like, not in the house. like, I just thought, like, it was spilled so juice or something. Good. Yeah, like, it was so funny. But, I mean, so, like, this little girl, if you think about it, they found her and she was hanging on to the arm of her very dilapidated, disintegrated mm-hmm. mother. This girl was already fucked up. Like, you know, who knows how long her mom was dead, but, like, she's been watching the plague go down, killing her friends, killing her family, killing the neighbors. Her mom died and she's, like, clinging and has been there, like, for weeks, who even knows. So I think that she was already a little bit messed up, and I think that she didn't need too much of a push for Lestat to be like, you want to be a mass murderer with me? And she's like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, she's 12. I mean, this is an extraordinary performance, like, for any actor, but you could say this 12-year-old, like Kiki Dunst, right? She's 12. She has to, her parents wouldn't let her see the film, by the way. They thought it was too scary for her. But she has to be this child, this precocious child. She screams, she stamps, she's, you know, she Shirley Temples her way around. And towards the end of the film, when she is now, is 30 years later, she's now 40 or 45 in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, the number of years that she's lived. This small actor manages to greatly helped by Sandy Powell, the costume designer, who now puts her into miniature adults' clothes mm-hmm. and the hair is up and the
muff,
jewelry.
I loved the muff that she had in that one scene. Just like, yes, I completely agree. The costumes were amazing.
Yeah, she manages to have this age on her, plus the age of, you know, the weight of being immortal, the weight of kind of hanging around Louis, who's no fun. We don't quite know ever, this is a bit naughty of me to say, but we don't know why ever, if Louis's so worried about all that, just go out in the sun and die. You know, he has that available to him. So I like that ambiguity that he says he can't live like that, but he is also not prepared to die. He's not prepared to give up his immortality. And he commits the one sin of a vampire, to kill your own kind. And he certainly does that in a spectacular fashion in the catacombs in Paris. And then that wonderful section of the film, it's a quieter section, but it's one of my favourites, where the years are turning mm-hmm. and we see him from age to age. And I love the films that he watches. He watches Nosferatu, and obviously that's not a mistake. Nosferatu also has the ambiguity of the immortal. It's only later in Twilight that it's all fun and games mm-hmm. to be a vampire. And he, well, then we see him coming out of Tequila Sunrise, which is also a movie that I watched at the time. So that's kind of very amusing. Wanting to fit in, not being able to fit in, stalking humans, because after he makes the companion for Claudia, he says, that was the last moment of my humanity dying. So, and he's so lovely to look at. We kind of sit with him through his gloom and doom. I mean, Thelma and Louise thought he was absolutely gorgeous as well, so much so that, you know, he stole all their money. So that was his kind of breakout role that we remember him from. I'm going all over the place now. What I wanted to talk about was this idea of the darkness within vampires and the complexity being simplified. I mean, I love Buffy, but there's a simplification there about vampires. And then Twilight, I have some objections to, you know, I can't penetrate you or I will kill you. It's all very repressive sexuality there. But it's this sort of sparkly vampire. I like my vampires a bit reeking of something. I like a dirtier vampire, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think this still has that, like, sexual quality, but obviously the exact opposite of repression, right? I really like the way the visual of the vampires in this movie, right? Like, they are very obviously pallid, very pale. I mean, I can only imagine how uncomfortable those contacts were, but they all have like the very light eyes. And they all have this, like, I don't know, every single vampire we see just has this gorgeous head of hair, whether it be Claudia with her curly locks that she, you know, tries to cut off and won't stay off, or, you know, you have Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise with their very long, like, luscious hair. I just like the, like, how, like, regal almost they look, but at the same time it is a very, like, visually dark movie, in that you could tell, like, they're all very sad people, with the exception of maybe Lestat, who I feel just, like, revels in the chaos and the blood and the gore and the and all of that. I think I like Louis more just because he is kind of like a self-hating vampire, right? Like, he hates this. He doesn't want to do any of this, which is how I feel most people would probably react to being turned into a vampire, not wanting to kill, not wanting to harm people, really just having... I feel like he's just had this grief and this dread following him since the death of his wife and unborn child, right? He tries to replace that by hooking up with Lestat and then turning Claudia and having his own little family. But yeah, I think, like, it's interesting the differences in different, the way different films portray vampires, and this being a very, like, mm-hmm. sexually charged, emotional, dark version of vampires. And, like, right, even Armand, who we're like, oh, great, okay, he's going to be buddies with Louis, he's going to, like, hang out with him. No, immediately we're going to, like, take these people, we're going to kill off Claudia and her new person that's watching over her, and so we can have Louis all to himself. I don't know. I just, Sarah, you didn't. I just feel like I, like, felt for Louis the most out of all of the characters. Just his journey felt very, like, real and sad.
The thing about Louis is that the more he complained, the less I liked him. He just became, like, very, like, sad sack, and it's just like, I get it, like, you're, like, you know, you're angsty, but it got to a point where, like, I don't know, like, when he started, like, sulking on the balcony towards the end, right before they got snatched, I was like, dude, you know, you just gotta let it go, like, it's okay, like, okay, so, like, for me, there's, like, different sections of this movie. There's the first section where it's like Lestat and Louis are on their own, and I call this, like, the dude frat bro situation. hated it when they were frat bros because they would go around and hook up with women and like kill people. And I was like, I don't like these douchey bros. Then we have the family. And I feel like this was like the best part when he was like all happy and he was like Claudia's like dad and we got like all the like clothing. And then we have like the third part where he gets like really doomy and gloomy. And he's just like, I don't know. He just becomes like a real wet blanket.
Very well as me.
Yeah, like
it's so pretty, like, so pretty, and that flowing blonde hair, gorgeous.
The pouty lips, like just pout, 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 because that's all he knows how to do. Like I feel like he was happy to go to Paris, but like I feel like Paris was no good for him. Like what? Like the whole point of looking, his whole thing was like, I want to know the reason to like be a vampire. Like, I want to know like my purpose. Right. It's like, there's no purpose. There's no purpose. Like, you have to let this go. Cause he's like, and then he like, he's like, you know, like Lestat never told me what my purpose was. Like, never told me. Like, I'm like upset with him because like he didn't teach me anything. And then he like is, they're on the hunt for vampires. Where do you think this is going to wind up, Louis? Like, there's no, like, when you meet others like you, you're not going to have, like, a club. Like, this is not going to be, like, the women's club of Transylvania. Like, you're doomed, dude.
See, it's interesting that Louis thinks that, like, the other vampires out in the world, right? That's why he travels so much, is to find other vampires. It's interesting that he thinks that, like, they're more likely to be like him and less like Lestat. At least you'd assume that because he's looking for them and he didn't like Lestat. So you'd think he thinks that they're going to be more merciful. But, like, if they're alive, Louis, they're drinking blood. Like, they're probably not merciful.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know Lestat does have a big thing about that he wasn't given the choice. So his moral point is that he will always give people the choice before he turns them. And other than that, it's he enjoys his non-life as a vampire. Yes, and it's true. Louis's 200 years younger than Lestat. He feels, what's the purpose? There's this seeking, there's this journeying. Armand sees him as the vampire from the new world. Armand is sort of, he's even older again. He's the oldest vampire that he knows. So presumably there comes a moment in a vampire's life where they will step into the light just to mm-hmm. finish their existence. And he sees Louis as this, you know, the new world, the new hope, I suppose. I mean, everybody puts whatever they want onto Louis. And in that, I feel he's a really successful character and a very successful performance from Brad Pitt. Because it's whatever you want Louis to be is who Louis is. And even Christian Slater sees him as this kind of exciting, interesting person that he sees in an alleyway and follows up to an apartment. So there's a sort mm-hmm. of beat there as well. There's a kind of gay undertone there that you are in San Francisco and you see a man across the street in an alley and you follow them up to their room. That's a very beat kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. But in fact, he wants to record him for his own purposes. And then is very excited about becoming a vampire. He hears Louis's story and then he wants to become a vampire.
Who thinks that way? It's, yeah. I mean, especially because Louis, like you said, Sarah, he's such a sad sack. Like, who hears that story and is like, this sounds like the life for me? Like, absolutely not.
So this is kind of my biggest question of this movie. We learn early on that everybody has their own abilities, their own special talents, which is kind of carries around in Twilight as well. Like, you know, so Lestat can read minds, which we know that Louis can't do because he tried and he can't do it. Right. So what is and like that one guy, Santiago, he like pops around and he's like trickery. So what is Louis's special talent? And does it have to do with his charisma? Like, does it have to do with, like, sucking people in? Is it the fact that he still keeps his, like, human side to him? Like, what is his special talent?
That's a really good point. And I think I mean, I absolutely love this movie, but were I to turn my, you know, critical eye on it, I would say that there's no plot. Sorry, everybody, if you haven't seen it. There's actually no plot. It's a series of things that happen to this person. And I don't mind that kind of movie at all, and particularly when it's so skillfully done and so beautiful and the set decorator is someone famous whose name just escapes me, Dante Ferretti, who did Sweeney Todd, he did Shutter Island, he did Gangs of New York, he did Age of Innocence. So he is incredibly skillful. And in fact, worked with Sandy Powell, the costume designer, on a couple of things as well. So they have a sort of working partnership that you can see the integration of both these designs. Sorry, off on another tangent here. And I love Neil Jordan. But the thing is, there are things that are brought up and dropped, and things that, and I think the different skills that everybody has is brought up, dropped, and then we see it when we go to Paris, and we see that Armand can presumably almost hypnotize somebody. One of my favorite scenes is the vampire theater, because that tension that we know they actually are vampires and the audience doesn't, and the girl that comes on they think is an actor and is of course a sacrifice, and she becomes mesmerized by Armand. So I like that. It's a point that's picked up, dropped, and picked up again when it's convenient. And it's the same for some of the themes that are picked up and dropped. In the early frat, I love the idea of the frat boys in the in the Louisiana Hacienda, whatever it's called, they jump from one part of their relationship to another. Mm-hmm. We don't see the connecting scenes. I actually really like that. I think that's a really assured filmmaker that says, yeah, you'll come with me. I don't have to show you the intervening argument. I can show you them very sort of sexually bound, and then I can show you them annoyed with each other. I don't have to show you all the little steps in between.
It kind of reads as a book. So obviously this is a book by Anne Rice, and Anne Rice wrote the screenplay. So it almost is like it's reading as a
like
book
chapters.
Almost. Like you're getting like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's feeling like chapters.
Yeah. And I love that they start. I love when movies start like at the end, if that makes. So he starts with like, and this is my story, and we're going back and we're recounting the time. Because like you were saying, Sarah, it is book-like. And I feel like it's really successful in that way, that there are these separate chapters of the movie, that even if there isn't like necessarily a plot, which you can feel, it feels a bit wandery at times. It's still interesting to watch. And you're like, what's going to happen? When is Lestat going to pop up again?
And when does he?
He never dies. Like every single time I thought he was dead. And then when especially then he's in the chair and he swivels around and like him. And this is like very right. We see a helicopter. So we're like, oh, wow, time has passed. And we see him in the chair and he just looks awful because he obviously is too weak to do anything. And I'm like, oh, OK, now he's actually going to die. Nope.
Nope.
No. So, yeah, like it's interesting because like he gave Louis such a hard time of living off rats his entire like in the early days, but that's how he was surviving for all those years. He like kind of degrades himself down to like the low levels of what he perceived Louis to do. Like he would shit on Louis all damn day about like, you're pathetic, you just eat rats and chickens, like you're not like a man, like you're not going to like do the deed. And like when he saw Claudia, who is like slitting like throats, like he was like, yes, like this is my prodigy. But like then, like for him to like go so low and actually be like living off rats for like decades and decades, I thought that was like kind of like a full circle moment. I don't exactly know how he, okay, well, hold on, like without like burying the lead too much, like talk about like probably the best ending to a movie like ever. I love the ending. Like, I think that probably, like, the ending is the best part of the movie. Not because it was ending. Like, I'm not trying to be fresh, which is, like, a joke that I've made before. But just, like, I think it's just, like, was such a good twist. Because we get, like, the reporter, like, Malloy, like, running out of there after Louis, like, threatens him. And he starts playing the tape. And then you're, like, there's no way his voice is actually going to show up on the tape. Like, obviously, it got erased. No, his voice is on the tape. Then he's listening to it, and it's like, okay, there's no way he's going to be able to escape and, like, get out of this. Like, okay. And then, like, someone attacks him, and you're like, oh, okay, so I guess Louis, hell no, is Lestat. He pops into the convertible. How'd he do it? I don't know, but he's there. And he, like, you know, gives him the choice that he was never given, which is, like, it's almost like it's not a choice. He's fully intentionally doing this to people to manipulate them into being his companion. And it is dark and is twisted, and then they play that Rolling Stones song, and it's rock and roll. It's, like, freaking awesome. It's, like, really cool.
I'm so happy that you like the ending. I just... watching it again, I was excited as that first time in the cinema seeing it. And, you know, that wonderful thing of, oh, Lestat can drive. Okay, great. Because he can. Of course he can.
How can he drive?
He just knows how to drive.
He shouldn't be able to drive.
Well, was he faking it? Like, was he faking, like, being all weak? Like, I don't...
No, because like, that
he didn't even know what a helicopter
passed.
Was.
But time has passed between when Louis last saw him and this time. Oh, so even though it's a modern time where now, you know, he's been slowly, you know, getting his strength.
Right, I think it's 1988.
So we saw him in
it was 88 when he went to New Orleans and when he was like really weak and living by himself. And then I presume it was 94. At least I presume it was 93, 94 when he's meeting with Malloy.
That makes sense. So then it's like, it's almost like, okay, so Louis left Lestat like that, hanging high and dry. I'm sure Lestat thought that he was coming back to see him in a way. And then it's like, that was his motivator to get off his decrepit chair. And
yeah.
Like,
how obsessed are you with Louis that you have to hunt him down like that? And the fun, because this is the Golden Gate Bridge. Like, not New Orleans. So he had to travel to get here.
He had to find him.
And the funny thing, the best part about this whole Lestat turning Malloy or, like, giving Malloy the choice, right, is we see Malloy, like, want to be Louis's companion. It seems like everybody wants to be Louis's companion. Lestat, Armand, and Malloy. But, like, Claudia. And Claudia. But, like, Louis isn't interested in that, really, right? He doesn't want to turn people. He wants companionship, but he doesn't want to have to turn these people into what he views as a very awful, hard thing to go through, a hard life to live. And meanwhile, Lestat's turning people left and right, but, like, he is not the companion you should want. Like, he obviously is not a very good mentor of new vampires.
Unless you're another dude bro frat guy. And then
he's all about it.
I mean, if there's two Lestats, then they're having a good day all day.
I feel like there'd be an ego fight, though. They're partying it up. No, like, Lestat has a massive ego. He wants, like, all the attention.
Absolutely. He can't even share it with a 12-year-old girl.
Exactly.
I mean, it's interesting that idea of companionship that runs all the way through. Mm-hmm. I mean, Armand has a boy who is not turned, who is a human, who is kept alive for them to drink. So that's part of the mythology as well, that you can just have a person that you just sip on because, you know, you're not... I love the greed. Sorry, just jumping again. I love the greed when Kiki first gets turned and she drinks the blood and she's so greedy for it. She's sort of almost scares Lestat. And the companionship, she wants someone, so she asks Louis to turn the woman for her, the woman who had the missing daughter. So again, that family idea. And that was an image that stuck with me so much, was the death of these two women.
It was awful.
Enfolded in each other's arms. Yeah.
That was really, I think, probably one of the hardest parts because, again, I thought Kirsten Dunst was so wonderful as Claudia. Like, any of the emotional scenes she had, right, when she's confronting Lestat about who turned me, did you do that, who did this to me, you know, like, how did I end up like this? She's so angry. She cuts off all her hair in a fit of rage. Like, I just felt like she was such a strong character, and just like, I felt like you really understood her in both senses, right? And when she's very immature and a kid and just like kind of living her life and doing crazy chaotic things. And then when she's Louise's companion, when she's, you know, 30 years have passed and she's obviously matured a lot. So to watch Claudia die in the arms of like her new like motherly companion, and they just can't do anything. They're stuck, right? The sunlight's going to kill them. They have nowhere to go. The fact that they built this like brick pit was just so awful. Like, it was so hard to watch.
Yeah. And then they put sealed Louis into a wall upside down. I mean, just horrifying. That whole sequence in Paris is very dark. It's very cruel. It's very, yeah, the feeling that's there exists in Louis and in Claudia, and in the woman that she finds, but not in these old European vampires that have lost any semblance of humanity, I think. So it's interesting that it is there that Louis says, that's the last of my humanity. Went when I turned this woman. Mm-hmm. And it's his gift to Claudia, but his gift to Claudia is self-sacrifice, which is a very parental kind of thing to happen. And then it's all for nothing. So, yeah, it's not anti-European so much as that idea of old, ancient, tired, stuck. And that's why Louis, again, as I said before, that's why Louis appears to them, this kind of shining new world, the new idea of a vampire. But the new idea of a vampire is just them, but not enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's like they've lived so long as vampires that, like, this is normal for them to be, like, sacrificing humans. And, like, it's the way they eat. So for them, it's no different, like, than humans eating a piece of chicken, you know? For them, it's the way they get their sustenance, whereas Louis is so just horrified by the whole thing. And Claudia is kind of taught that it's fine. And she's a kid, so I don't know that how much you can actually fault her until she's a little, you know, has the maturity to kind of understand. But yeah, it is fascinating. I will say that, like, the Paris part, while it was, like, gorgeous to watch, like, the actual theater troupe part of the movie, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like so much. Like, it was hard to watch at moments, just because you go from them sacrificing a woman, like, literally on stage in front of people. She's like completely nude, never been more vulnerable in her entire life, I'm sure. To then, like, Claudia and her new caretaker being killed brutally, and Louis being, like you said, stuck and upside down. It's like all these series of events are so horrifying that they're like, okay, first we're going to show you the, like, love and family and all of that, and then we're going to go straight into the horrifying details of what being a vampire actually is about.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And then the fact that, like, I don't know, Louis was given, like, an extra chance, essentially, and he, like, in, like, Antonio Banderas was basically like, I can teach you all that you want to know. And because he was, like, essentially assisting or came up with the plan of, like, kidnapping and killing Claudia so that he can have Louis to himself, I thought that was, it was pretty horrific too. And then, like, obviously Louis is like, well, I'm not sticking around for you.
Yes, and the fact that he thinks that Louis will just come to him because he's mesmeric, yeah, it's
we'll be okay with that.
Yeah, it's very touching when he finds their remains. Mm-hmm. But I think it just, I can't go without bringing up a couple more scenes of Kirsten Dunst. I mean, really, it cannot be underestimated. Her performance is incredible. Yeah. But there's a moment, and again, very charged, very erotic, where the two men and the little girl all look up at a window, and there's a nude woman in a window washing herself, which is a very, it's an incredible, I mean, it happens in Witness as well, that idea of looking at a woman bathing. It's biblical too. People are punished and have their eyes pulled out for looking at women bathing. But it's very erotic. They look and... Lestat said, oh, do you want her? And she says, I want to be her. And that's the beginning of her maturity and the beginning of her understanding that mm-hmm. she won't grow up, that she won't ever have womanly parts. And in fact, Lestat very cruelly says to her, you'll never have breasts. You'll never have those parts that these women have. And I love that you can see the thinking behind the eyes there. And the other scene of hers that I absolutely adore is when she's trying to charm Lestat and she says, I've got you a present. And yes. she takes him through to the room. And then there's those two gorgeous little plump twin boys yeah. apparently asleep.
I love when she's oh, they're drunk. Like, she's so yeah. manipulative in the best way.
Well, we're happy because we want her to escape from Lestat at this point. Mm-hmm. But if you think about what she does, she kills these two boys with laudanum so that they will be warm, but the blood will be dead, so that when Lestat drinks it, he will become completely destroyed.
So is this a popular thing in vampire lore that you can't drink dead blood?
I think it's a great convenience because it means if you were a moral vampire that didn't want to kill people, you could just go to a graveyard. Oh,
because that's kind of like what in the beginning, that's what I was thinking, like, especially with like the plague. I was like, I mean, nobody wants to drink plague blood, but at first I was like, oh, like, I thought that he was just going to drink all the dead bodies from the plague. I was like, oh, that's pretty easy.
So I don't know if this is a thing in vampire pop culture, but in my mind, the way it works is like, yes, you could like make an arrangement with a farm to get like, you know, animals to drink their blood to sustain you. But like in my head, human blood is what tastes the best. So it's probably the difference between eating a stick of beef jerky and filet mignon. And so these vampires are kind of greedy, right? And so they want the best of the best. And like, I believe it was Lestat who says that, oh, the ones who were the worst taste the best or something like that at some point in the film. Which I guess, I don't know, you'd think it'd be the opposite, that the more innocent you are, the better your blood tastes, because usually it's like, oh, you're bad blood, right? But I just, I love that.
Spicier. Maybe if you're innocent, you taste like vanilla.
Yeah, maybe you like spice.
If you're a bit debauched, yeah, you're a bit spicy. I mean, it's interesting because one of the great things that the script does, and I believe that Neil Jordan had a lot to do with the script, so, you know, hard to know whose contribution was what, but it does give you the rules of this world of vampires, you know, quite efficiently, yeah. very early on and very naturally, so that when Christian Slater's Malloy says, oh, what about crucifixes, and Louise says, oh, I quite like crucifixes, and, you know, garlic is complete nonsense, but sunlight, you know, does harm us, and the stake through the heart is also nonsense. So it gives you those rules, and then when Louis turned, he gets a few more rules. And I think the thing with vampires is that there's so much folklore, you can sort of pick and choose what you like. For example, they all reflect in mirrors, which is a popular thing that vampires don't reflect.
Yeah.
And as
yeah,
you
I
said,
noticed that.
The first time I saw it, when he put the cassette tape, kids, ask your parents or your grandparents what a cassette tape is. When he puts the cassette tape in the car stereo, also ask your parents, you do expect that the voice is not going to be there. But the thing is that the film has taught us that they do reflect, right. So why also would they not?
Like, they don't mind crucifixes.
He quite likes them.
He thinks they're pleasant looking.
Pleasant to look at. You know, yeah. And let's remember that a crucifix is not a cross. A cross is just the cross, like a plus sign, mm-hmm. with a longer stem. A crucifix has the tortured body of a man nailed to it.
Yeah.
He quite likes them. He finds them pleasant. Catholics, what are you like?
What is that about?
Yeah. Apparently, a stake through the heart does not necessarily kill them, but they do need to sleep in coffins.
Oh, yeah, that was the other thing I did want to bring up, is I thought it was very sweet, although a little strange. I'm not a parent. I should start by preface by saying that when Louis and Claudia kind of, you know, she'll go in her own coffin and then she'll kind of sneak out, scurry out and get into his coffin. Very like a child in the morning, you know, going to cuddle up with mom or dad in the bed. And I just thought that was like a very sweet touch, right? Where like, despite them being vampires, she still is a child and she still wants that companionship, that love, that warmth. So I loved that.
So I don't know if the movie The Orphan has like permanently ruined me, but if you don't know, okay, spoilers. Spoilers. So The Orphan has a little girl in it, and the entire movie, it's a little girl. They adopted this little girl, and she starts doing weird things, and she's very cuddly with the dad. And then the twist at the end, once again, spoiler alert, is that it's a really like a 40-year-old woman. And a lot of what she's doing with the dad, it was perceived as sexual, but he kept like pushing it away and be like, no, it's just a kid, it's just a kid. But she was attracted to this man that was her adopted father. And for me, this movie skated the line of, this is my daddy, and this is my daddy, if you know what I mean. And I felt like there was times where it almost went there, but didn't quite. And I was just waiting for that other shoe to drop where it's like going to turn and be like disturbing. And of course, yeah, there's the infamous kiss, but the infamous kiss wasn't very sexually charged because the scene that happens is that they said that, okay, we're even, like, you turned me and I took away the last part of humanity in you, we're even. And she was thinking that she was gonna leave, and then of course mid kiss they all get kidnapped and snatched by the vampire crew, the theater crew. So did you guys feel that as well, or was I kind of reading into something that wasn't really there?
No, I think, you know, in her later years, yeah, when she's a grown-up woman, she does refer to him as my beloved, and he calls her my beloved. So there's a very partner-esque, but not necessarily lover-esque air to them. No longer father and daughter, but rather, you know, the loves of each other's lives, companions, yeah, and strangely less sexual than when she was, you know, having a good old suck when she was 12. And I think the kiss is very interesting, not just because, you know, of her own feelings about kissing Brad Pitt, but it's one of the most chaste moments of this, you know, movie's redolent with sensuality and sexuality. Mm-hmm. It's the sealing of this bargain. They're going to part. And it's the first time that we've sort of seen that kind of thing where she kisses him on the lips. And yes, it's interrupted, but you feel it's not a great big open mouth and a frenzy of darting tongues. It's in fact just this chaste kiss on the lips to seal the bargain and to say goodbye very particular way that they haven't before. So no, I don't think you're wrong at all. I think there's a shift as she ages to just, you know, being each other's loves, really.
Yeah, I think the word companion is just on point for this entire movie, right? Like, they always call them companions, and I feel like they're companions in more ways than one. Because if you think about it, if you are someone's companion, but you're both immortal, like, you're going to mentally age, and you're going to age out of whatever that relationship started out as, right? Like, mother-daughter, father-daughter type of thing turns into maybe a mentor-mentee, turns into maybe lovers down the line. You know what I mean? There's so many facets of these companions, especially considered how many pairings we have in this film. There's tons of them. There's Louis and Lisette, and there's Lisette and Claudia, Lisette and, you know, there's just so many that I think it's, and they all have different types of relationships to each other. They all kind of have this underlying, like, I mean, they all have that in common, that they're all immortal, and they're all living this particular life, and they feel like they can't do it alone, which is interesting to think about. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like in some versions you would have a vampire who's like, I'm so, especially like a Louis type of vampire, where they're like, I'm so disgusted by who I am that I don't want anybody to see me, right? I don't want anybody to look at me. I don't want anybody to know what I'm doing. But instead, it's more of a, I need to find my people. I need to find my group that understands me and can teach me their ways because I'm new at it. That was something I just thought was fascinating from the movie. And we did talk about this in the beginning, but just the fact that this was 1994, and we do have, like, gender does not matter in this film. It doesn't matter at all. They're all companions, mm-hmm, to one another, despite the fact that, like,
it wasn't a common thing to have, you know, gay relationships, erotic gay relationships on your screen. 94. That was something I really enjoyed about the movie, that like, it was like, wow, we talk a lot on the podcast about how stuff doesn't age well, or like, this is never a joke that would be made in 2021. But this is something that is like, wow, this is progressive for its time. And I really loved that about it.
It's progressive for now. If you think of these two, or indeed, you know, three with Christian Slater, you know, very masculine presenting film stars in the bloom of their youth, you know, and Antonio Banderas slightly older, but nonetheless the same, and that they gave themselves over so completely to this, you know, I keep saying erotic and sensual, but it's exactly what this film is. It's and you think they don't hold back, any of them, and I think it's true. When you say what doesn't hold up, it's very hard to see what doesn't hold up now. I mean, I think people be slightly more horrified that Kiki's only 12, like literally only 12, not just a 15-year-old girl, even though that.
And I think in the book she was even younger.
She's 6 in the book. So, you know. So Anne Rice's dreams must be quite extraordinary. but I mean, I love this director. I love the look of this film. I love the costumes.
The costumes are gorgeous.
It's fabulous. Yeah. Fabulous is one of the words that we used to say then, and I shall say it now.
Yeah, it has a very distinct look and feel. Is how I felt, because again, this is in the wiki article, it says it's a gothic horror film.
Yeah.
Which, like, there is a lot of gore, right? Like, if you watch this film, you know, there's a lot of blood, whether it looks real or not, I'll leave up to everybody else, but there's a lot of blood in the film, but like, it's not gonna jump scare you. I mean, maybe the end will stop, but like, most of the film is not there to scare you. It is not there to make you frightened. Probably not there to give you nightmares. Mm-hmm. It may or may not give you nightmares, but it's not really the point of the movie. And so I feel like they really, I feel like it, gothic is probably the more appropriate word for it.
Yeah.
Because it's a whole vibe about this movie.
Exactly.
And Sarah, I know you must have loved the fashion, because like, it's just intricate, I guess, is the word I would use.
Yeah, I mean, it was extremely detailed, and obviously we're dealing with historical fashion from different eras, going from the 1700s all the way up to the 80s and 90s, so a lot of centuries were represented, even paying close attention from a 1700 garb to an 1800 garb to a 1900 garb. Like, you know, there's absolutely differences, and even, you know, to the hairstyles as well. There's different hairstyles that were popular in all these years. And then, of course, we have, you know, American fashion versus Parisian fashion. So it's all very, very intricate, very detailed. Going back to the genre, I think the genre, I would categorize it as gothic drama, and I would put it in the same camp as Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, The Addams Family, even like Batman Returns, like all of these like gothic, they're not quite horror films, they're gothic dramas. And they all have this distinct look to them. Sleepy Hollow, The Craft, it's all movies that high school Sarah was very into, because I fancied myself a baby emo, and it was mainly because I was emotional.
Is that a BMO?
I was really feeling this, my Johnny Depp
side bangs. In the eyes, with the eyeliner on the waterline and all on the bottom lash line.
Yep. Yep, that's what I was doing.
Black nail polish on, good to go.
So, I mean, it was a sad, sad moment. But, of course, the sets were extremely detailed. It was a gorgeous movie. I really enjoyed those elements of it. And I think in terms of like being recognized by the Academy, those were the categories that they were nominated for. And I think they might have won something. Maybe not.
Oscar nominations for Best Art Direction and Best Original Score. Kirsten Dunst was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress for her role. I don't see that they won anything, though. I think they were just nominated.
Oh, I mean, it's an honor to be nominated.
It's an honor just to be nominated.
Especially, I think that, like, if I was going to give anyone a nomination, like, I think the nod would go to Kirsten Dunst. I just think that she was so impressive. And even forgetting she's a child actress, right, at the time, even put her next to Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt, and she holds her own in an amazing way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Acting her heart out.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't mentioned the music, but the music also got a nomination for Elliot Goldenthal, and the music is fantastic, or the original music, and then going to that Stone Sympathy for the Devil at the end is just
brilliant. It was so cool. It was so cool.
Although it's not the Stones singing it, I used to know who it was, but yeah,
Black Sabbath. Who is it?
It's a Stone song, but it was a more contemporary. Mm-hmm. Band. I'll look that up
I also loved in that scene where once Lissette took over the wheel and he was listening to the tape, he was like, Louie, still whining after all
Sarah really
years.
Loved that. She was like, I'm so tired of him whining.
Okay, because so it was okay, so like, you know, you guys know us. We like to talk about astrology once in a while. Just a smidge. Little bit. Like, if Louis was not, like, a, like, triple Pisces, then I don't know. Actually, I think I decided Pisces, Sun, Cancer, Moon, because he loves a family mm-hmm. element. And he's, like, a homebody. But definitely, like, Pisces rising. And then definitely Pisces, Venus. And probably, like, he was so all water, which is so ironic considering how much he loved fire and setting fire to all of his fancy homes. Oh, that was the other thing. When he set fire to their first fancy home, and, like, Lestat was like, you ruined all of our stuff. Now look where we are. We're in the cemetery. Like, what are we going to do now? Like, just, like, whenever Tom Cruise just, like, acted out about, like, whatever fancy-ass thing that he was, like, complaining about, I was living for it. Like, whenever he was, like, he's like, who's going to do your dresses now? And, like, all this is so funny. Whenever he was acting like a little prima donna, I was living for it.
And it's interesting that mansion, house, home, hacienda, was still in that old burnt state when he found Lestat in 1988.
Why didn't it get plowed?
Because who owns it? Louis still owns it.
Louis still owns it. He's like, nope, nobody can bulldoze my crusty burned down house.
It's Guns N' Roses who sing that. Sympathy for the Devil at the end. Yes. Yeah, I knew it's a Stone song, but I knew it was a cover. Like perfection. Very, very 90s.
Oh my gosh, I just saw on the wiki, it says on June 24th, 2021, AMC announced a television adaptation of Interview with the Vampire, giving a series order consisting of 8 episodes. It's going to be created by Roland Jones, who's expected to executive produce alongside Mark Johnson and Rice and Christopher Rice.
Oh, she's
involved.
She has to.
I love
to do
that.
It.
I
so
think
this
you,
is coming.
If you see your product, like, you want to be involved in the creative storytelling of your own, you know, work.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I wonder how it will. It's almost like it might work as a series better, because then that episodic nature of 8 episodes would be like this chapter, then this bit, then this bit. Chapters. Yeah. Anything about cast?
I mean, the cast was amazing, right? Like, you mean on this?
No, the new cast.
I'm not seeing anything. I'm gonna search a little bit more though, because this was just
like
at
a Johnny
Depp
moment. I'm gonna propose a theory for you guys. Ooh. What would you say if I told you, let's a little think piece, Interview with a Vampire is actually about the horrors of domestic life?
Now, if you think about it, we have a couple, a new couple that has found each other, Lisette and Louis, and there starts to be resentment. And Louis feels like he got dragged into something that he didn't totally agree with.
Oh my God, I love this.
Now, we have like, okay, so there's a disagreement and Louis wants to leave. But Lisette is like, let's have a kid. That will fix everything. Right? That happens all the times with couples. But then the kid, like when you have a kid, it doesn't fix everything. More problems start showing. So then Lisette is like acting out. And then Louis and Claudia is like, we got to get going. And then, of course, Lisette like freaks out about that. And it's like, don't leave. You can't leave. It's like they're trapped. So then they like really go. And then guess who pops up later? It's literally a story about marriage.
You're completely divine. What about going after each other's exes, though? That's kind of fun.
Yeah. Like, Armand. Oh, yeah. That's like twisted. Yeah, that's twisted. Like, oh, I'll hook up with your ex. Yeah.
So I did see, I found who's playing Lestat. And it's actually an Australian actor. Sam Reed is who's slated to play Lestat in the new AMC series. Apparently, it's going to be the first season is going to be later this year, and on AMC and its sister streamer AMC Plus in 2022.
Oh, $5.99 a month, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Oh. He fits the bill. Sarah just showed us a picture of who this kid is.
Yeah, he's blonde, blue-eyed, very pale. Apparently,
chiseled.
Yeah, he was in Foxtel's Lambs of God. He was in a four-part SBS series, The Hunting. I haven't seen any of these, but...
SBS is one of our television networks. It stands for Sex Before Soccer.
Oh.
No, it's Special Broadcasting Services.
I believed you fully.
Oh.
Also, I know.
We call it Sex Before Soccer because it had European films and subtitle things. Oh. It's diversity. Its charter is diversity. So they're all the kind of the sexy European films that show a bit of tit. And then you watch soccer. So.
I know that. Who's going to be Claudia as well. Bailey Bass. Has been tapped to star as Claudia. She, we're getting some diversity at the very least because she's not white. And I'm just looking to see. She looks older. Like, she's certainly not as young as Kirsten Dunst was. But it says she was in the Avatar sequels, apparently.
Oh, she's gorgeous.
Yeah, she's beautiful. Oh, she was in, at age 13, she was in James Cameron's Avatar sequels 2 and 3. And then, apparently she guest starred on Law & Order SVU.
Her and everybody else.
Yeah. So,
I would be very surprised if they cast a 12-year-old in 2021.
Yeah. I'm most curious to know, though. I want to know who's playing Louis. I'm going to see if I can find that because that's interesting. I know I have to check this out. I feel like I want to know. Yeah, I want to know how this looks in television form. Oh, here we go. Oh my gosh, he's from Game of Thrones.
Ooh.
Jacob Anderson is going to play Louis. He I'm trying to think of his character's name from Game of Thrones. Grey Worm. So another non-white cast member.
Oh, neat.
Great. Yeah, and he is gorgeous. Yeah, he's gorgeous. Oh. So makes perfect sense. They obviously want very attractive people for these vampire roles, I'd imagine.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
I mean, I'm not complaining.
No. Only hot vampires.
Has there ever been... I mean, I'm sure there has, but like, I love to speculate. Has there ever been like an unsexy vampire in any pop culture situation?
Buffy. Some of the vampires in Buffy, when they turn, are a little unpleasant, but they're kind of human faces. Well, it's television. I just wanted to mention, this is something probably one of the sort of things that everybody knows about the casting, was that River Phoenix was not only supposed to play Morlo, but in fact they had already started filming with him when he died. And while I can see like some of the other alternate casting that we've talked about, I wonder whether because it's hard again to know, like, while we were watching River at the time and he was becoming this huge star. I mean, he was quite extraordinary and magnetic, and we loved watching him, and he was really good in everything. I wonder if he would have had too much of the Louis in him, too much of the sort of reflective, slightly melancholic in him. The great thing about Christian Slater, I mean, I love Christian Slater. Enthusiasm is his kind of watchword. Certainly when he was a young man, all his roles are incredibly enthusiastic, and he brings that kind of, he's got the fresh haircut. He doesn't have the long hair. So if he gets turned into a vampire, he's going to have short hair. That's a serious no-no. He'll have to wear wigs. But what do you know of River Phoenix? What is he to you?
Gosh, like, I'm trying to think of what I would know him best from.
Stand By Me.
So Jess hasn't seen Stand By Me.
I haven't seen that yet. But I know who he is. Like, I know about him. I know his name. I know what he looks like. So, like, yeah, I mean, he's another gorgeous guy that could have been in the movie. I probably do know him best from Stand By Me, despite not having seen it. Like, I feel like that's probably.
Well, this is the thing. It's in the culture. It's in the air. I think too. The other thing about Christian Slater is, I mean, he's handsome, but he's handsome. He's a very contemporary face, whereas Brad Pitt, River Phoenix, Tom Cruise, I wouldn't have thought, but ended up having a kind of, you can see them in a period drama.
Yeah.
And that's the freshness, I think, of Christian Slater, is he has a very, very contemporary face. It is partly the haircut, but it's also just the structure of him. He looks very American, which the others don't so much. So, you know.
I personally feel as though River Phoenix, just looking at, like, his look, I feel as though perhaps he auditioned for Louis and did not get it and then was offered the role of Malloy. I think that's what makes sense to me, because he looks as though he is a Brad Pitt type. You know how in Hollywood they're like, I want a Brad Pitt type. There is River Phoenix.
Yeah. I mean, obviously a gorgeous guy, right? Like, come on.
Right. So maybe, in my opinion, he could have been like a secondary option for Louis. And then when they settled on Brad Pitt, then perhaps they offered him a different role.
Again,
and that's probably how they landed there.
And in terms of their sort of ranking in Hollywood, probably much the same, you know, rising, strong, leading men.
Now, I think, I don't know, like, this movie, going into it, I really didn't have very high expectations. Again, you see horror, and that is just not my thing. I'm very much, I stick to my lane, you know, like, I know what my lane is and I stay there and I don't venture into the spooky, scary stuff most of the time. But it impressed me, like, just with how full and rich it was. And not at all, like, this isn't gonna give me nightmares, you know, like, it's not the type of movie. I think that, like, the poster for it, and the fact that it has vampires, I think is kind of what leads you to believe, like, it's going to be one specific thing. But then you even look deeper into the poster, right? And it's like, it's Tom Cruise, like, looking, or not Tom Cruise, I'm sorry, wait, is it, it is Tom Cruise, isn't it?
The poster's Tom Cruise.
But it, interestingly enough, like, he looks more like sensual in this pose on the poster, and it's just like, that's actually what the movie is, you know. It's about love and loss and companionship, and they're vampires, versus, you know, it's all about the vampire-ness of it all, like a Twilight type of nonsense monster that is. And I really liked it, and, like, I could see myself watching this movie again, because I think because of its richness you miss things, right? And it is silly, and there are moments that are, like, funny, and not like laugh out loud funny, but like the Claudia scenes where she's flipping out, or, you know, when she tricks Lestat, it's like, yes, get him. But it definitely was a better movie than I expected it to be, and I'm happy we watched it, and I'm happy that, like, I'm, like, opening myself up to new movies. That's what I love about doing the podcast, is, like, revisiting some nostalgic things for myself, but then, like, opening myself up to things that, like, I didn't experience when it came out. You know, I was very young in 1994. I wouldn't have seen this movie. My parents would have been like, I would have been taken away from my parents if they brought me to see this movie in 1994. But I'm happy I watched it. I feel like it was a good film. What about you, Sarah? How do you feel watching this, having watched this for the first time?
So for me, It's kind of interesting. I didn't have that much expectations going into it. I feel as though this movie has actually grown on me throughout the day. So while watching it, it was a very, like, I don't know what's happening here. And, like, I feel as though, like, honestly, like, everything was happening. I'm like, I have no clue. And then throughout the day, I kind of just simmered on it and thought about it. And it grew on me throughout the day. And I started appreciating, like, how big this world is. And, like, all the fine details. And I started, like, you know, thinking about certain things that I really liked about it. And although I felt like I came out of a fever dream, ultimately I landed on, like, this is the type of movie that you need to watch, like, a few times to really understand and, like, appreciate all the fine details of it. And of course, like I said, like, I think the ending was spectacular. So I really, like, liked that. There was a lot of, like I said, like, I think I was less of a fan of the frat bro situation. Everything with Claudia I really liked. I was, like, perplexed by the theater group. But then going back, it's just like an adventure. Like, this dude, like, we saw him live 200 years of life. And it's like, you know what? I'm glad that he went on an adventure. It's much better than just, like, sitting at home and
drinking rat blood.
Like, drinking rap blood. Like, I'm glad that he went on this life adventure and, like, he wasn't wasting his time playing, like, softball with the other vampires.
The vampires.
Yeah. So, no, like, I definitely, like, even today, I've grown an appreciation for this movie.
I think the conversation helped, like, understand some of the, like, deeper implications of the movie, and talking through it also kind of made me appreciate it even more for what it was, because it isn't just a horror film. It's not even really a horror film. There's so much more to it. And so I think talking through it and the performances and the meaning behind everything really makes you appreciate it more.
Yeah, Sarah, I'm curious, like, did you take anything new from your newest rewatch this time around?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, one of the extraordinary, I haven't seen it for a few years, but one of the extraordinary things is, like, how much I knew it. Like, I knew certain scenes, certain looks, even a glass on the table, or a line like, evil is a point of view, which I absolutely love. I love the humor in it. I'd forgotten the humor. I think everything else was sort of a glorious warm bath of memory, and I do remember seeing it the first time in the cinema. And the progressiveness of the sexuality, I don't want to say that it was the norm, but it wasn't as surprising as you might think, looking back to the old days. And in fact, you know, the horror that Tom Cruise was going to play the role meant that we were expecting it to have that kind of air to it. But what I think each time I watch it, I forget the humour in it when he pushes aside the dead piano teacher and has to teach the piano himself, and his annoyance at that. I mean, Lestat is just brilliant. Lestat is our sort of raging id that just does whatever it wants. And there's something very, very attractive about that. While also being absolutely exhausting to live with. So I like that he comes and goes. While he's the more attractive, let's say, in terms of personally attractive character, you can't have him the whole time, or he would drive you mad, as he does to his partners. And I was less frustrated with Louis, I think, than I've been in the past. You know, I think I've always thought, well, just go outside, stand in the sun. But there was... He has such an understanding of his own tragedy that I really appreciated this time. And something that I reflect on and I haven't thought about before is the moment before he meets Lestat, he is about to be killed by the pimp.
Mugger?
Yeah. Well, he takes the prostitute out of the bar.
Right.
She goes to her knees in the classic fashion, and we see her pimp has followed, and he's getting out the knife, and then the pimp... whoosh, disappears off the screen, which is a wonderful sort of introduction to Lestat. But it also means that you know, he had a moment where it wasn't a choice, that he could have died, but in fact he goes to the arms of Lestat. And while I don't subscribe to the theory that there's one person for everyone, I love the theme of people who are meant to be together in literature and film and operas, of course, and plays. So it's that these two are bound together in some way, are meant to be together in some way, and yet cannot be.
Yeah.
So that's, I like that that push-pull that we see there, and we see, you know, repeated in so many other movies. And it's a fascinating thing. You know, it'd be exhausting to live through, but it's wonderful to vicariously follow. So I was thrilled that when you asked me what I would like to do, and I was very happy that you liked the movie.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on, Sarah. This was truly a joy, and I think that, like, I mean, usually this is our second year covering some Halloween content, and we usually stick to the more nostalgic, lighthearted Halloween movies, more for children probably. Than,
right, like Halloween Town. More like a child's
focused.
We did Casper in Halloween Town last year.
Yeah. But at the same time, I think that, like, this has shown me that, like, no, we can, like, we can cover this type of movie, and, like, I can feel satisfied with it. Like, I can find, as long as it's not, like, gore for gore's sake, right, like, gratuitous in a way that is just, like, completely unrealistic or unnecessary, I enjoyed it. And I think that, like, this movie has, like, talking it through really has made me enjoy it even more than I did watching it today. And I'm just so pleased, Sarah, that you came on, because it's always a joy to talk to you. And I'm just, and like,
your
input is just so valuable, and you always just have such, like, insightful things to say. So I'm so pleased that you came on.
Stop. Thank you. I'll take my flowers. Actually, no, I should take my flowers. Yes.
I'm glad we made the time zones work in our favor.
Oh, of course. But I can do it at one. I can be this entertaining at 1 a.m. as well. So don't worry about that.
Sarah, do you want to give the people a little bit of a tease of what we have coming up in November for our bonus content? I don't know how we want to tease it. Do we want to say we're doing another, like, themed month?
Yeah, we're doing another actor-focused themed month. So two movies, one actor, well, multiple actors. There's a lot of actors. It's not like a one-woman show. But yeah, so, stay tuned. We're really excited for that. Of course, we have our weekly Dawson's Creek and Boy Meets World content. So, earlier in the month, if you missed it, we did Halloween Town 2, which was a lot of fun. You can catch us at Shit90sPod on Twitter and Instagram. We have a website, www.shit90sPod.com. Sarah, what are you up to these days? Where can we find you? What are you up to? Where are you going?
Oh, it's a wonderful question. You can find me out in the podcasting streets. I've been talking about wrestling with Matt and Mari, which was amazing. I know absolutely nothing about it, but nonetheless, I was able to speak about it for 3.5 hours. I did a little show with Jess called Community Building. I had so much fun there. And I've already put my bid in for season 3.
Yes.
And I did a sort of follow-up Married at First Sight. I did episode 2 with Amy and Asia. And then they asked me back for episode 13, where things had taken a very dark turn. So we were able to open all of that.
That show is so much fun. Everyone should check out Married at First Sight, because it is just like, if you like 90 Day Fiancé, watch Married at First Sight, because it's a very, like, similar vibe.
It's bonkers. You will have an opinion. And whether you watch it or not, you should listen to Asia and Amy break it down every week, because they are fantastic and insightful and wonderful, wonderful women. And I have a new project, which I can't talk about. So I too can tease, not just you. I too can tease, be able to talk about that very soon. But I am very excited.
All exciting stuff. I love teasers for things. It's like, gets me like and so excited.
If you want to follow me, you can follow me at Sarah Carradine on Twitter.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on, Sarah. As always, you can find me at the Jess Sterling on Twitter. I'm also, like Sarah mentioned, on Community Building, as well as the Succession podcast over at Post Show Recaps. We've just started, so definitely go give that a listen. The premiere of season 3 was amazing, and I'm just so excited for what's in store for this season. So go give that a listen as well. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for the spooky month of October. So excited for everything coming up in November. We will talk to you all next time. Have a good one, everybody. Bye.
Goodbye, sweet prince.
Say goodbye to the light. Just ask. Shit 90 shows taught
me. Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.